Welcome to Animal Voices on CAUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhovsky, and I'll be taking you through the next, hour or so, 58 minutes at this point. I'm excited about today's show. Excited and maybe a little nervous because the person who we're having on today is a fairly big figure in the animal rights and specifically animal abolition communities. We're speaking today with Gary Francione. Gary Francione will be talking to us today all about his latest abolition campaign that he's been spearheading along with a bunch of other people who are involved with him. It's called The World is Vegan If You Want It. And Gary Francione is a distinguished professor of law and Nicholas D. E. B. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law at Newark. It should be an interesting conversation. We're going to talk about the state of the abolitionist movement today and where Gary sees it going from here. But before we do that, we are going to do our customary news pieces. And the first piece of news coming to us today from www.wenatcheeworld.com. This was an interesting one that I found for its sort of insider perspective that it gives. The headline is, U.S. Livestock Industry Struggling. Many challenges have hit in 2009 and continue. It's a little wonder that farmers fret about the future of the livestock industry. In the past 2 years, feed costs have skyrocketed, pork and dairy prices plummeted, and animal rights groups stepped up efforts to improve living conditions for farm animals. Some farmers are hoping to strike back with proactive efforts to ward off unwanted legislation and boost struggling industries. Quote, a line must be drawn between our polite and respectful engagement with consumers and how we must act aggressively to respond to extremists who want to drag agriculture back to the day of 40 acres and a mule, said Bob Stallman, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Quote, the time has come for us to face our opponents with a new attitude, he told some 5,000 members gathered in Seattle for the group's annual convention last week. Quote, the days of their elitist power grabs are over. Several segments of the livestock industry found 2009 to be a rough year. Everyone suffered with higher feed and energy costs, pig farmers endured slow pork sales that were triggered in part by the H1N1 flu virus, also known as swine flu, even though the U.S. Department of Agriculture had said swine flu cannot be transmitted by eating pork products. Dairy farmers found it even tougher. Francis and Beverly Cherney of Millidor, Wisconsin, who had been dairy farming for 47 years, saw small profits last year. Quote, a couple of dollars, Beverly said with a laugh. Low prices won't make them quit, but they know other dairy farmers who have sold their farms because they were already struggling. Quote, from a dairy farmer perspective, we're concluding the worst year financially we've ever had. 2009 was just a train wreck, said Jay Gordon, executive director of the Washington State Dairy Federation. The U.S. produces 25% of the world's milk, but operates under a dated pricing system that was developed in the heart of the Great Depression, he said. Stallman said dairy struggles are a hot topic among his members, but he doesn't expect them to recommend any sweeping policy changes before the next farm bill in 2012. Animal welfare and efforts by animal rights groups to regulate farmers are another matter, he said. The Humane Society of the U.S. has shepherded laws in at least 6 states to ban cramped cages for farm animals and persuaded some of the country's largest fast food restaurants and retailers to make at least a gradual switch to cage-free eggs. The group last year championed a ban on tail docking at California dairies. Ohio farmers struck back by promoting a constitutional amendment to create a livestock care standards board. Some 50,000 signs and 100-plus billboards touted the proposal, which 64% of voters approved. Quote, I really view Ohio as a culmination of California, Colorado, Florida, and all the states where the Humane Society has stepped up its efforts, Stallman said. We have learned something every step of the way, and it's culminated in a win for us in Ohio. Quote, no doubt we have to have agricultural unity in our states to survive these challenges, he said. Scott and Tammy Chu, who operate a large cattle ranch near Vernal, Utah, worry similar efforts in Utah are just a matter of time. Quote, I definitely feel like the people that are talking about animal rights are very passionate about what they're doing, Scott Chu said. I'm concerned there's a lot of money behind them, they're well-educated people, and know how to get their message across. I think there will be more of an effort to educate people that we do take care of our animals. And that's the end of the story. And if you want to find the full text of that is mostly the full text, but a little bit of bridge, do check out www.wenatcheeworld.com. wenatcheworld.com for the full story. The next story coming to us from the New York Times via the Associated Press, the headline is Austria, Experiment on Pigs Suspended. This is just a short one, but maybe give you an idea of where the state of animal testing is at, if you think animal testing is a thing of the past, as I did before I found out otherwise. You know, I thought the body shop had kind of taken care of it. Have a listen to this story. After protests by animal rights activists, scientists temporarily stopped an experiment on Thursday that involved burying pigs in snow and monitoring their deaths. The two-week experiment was intended to determine which factors make it possible for people to survive an avalanche in an air pocket without suffering brain damage. Hermann Brugger, co-director of the experiment led by the Institute of Mountain Emergency Medicine in Italy and the Medical University of Innsbruck, said the pigs did not suffer because they were sedated and given an anesthetic. Animal rights activists called it cruel and pointless. So there you go, a very, very small but important victory, at least for those pigs who are being buried in snow to the death. The final story isn't really a story, but I wanted to read it anyway because I'm hoping it'll provide a good sort of jumping-off point for the interview with Gary Francione. This is an editorial that was written by a man who goes by the name of, let me just find it for you, Victor Schoenfeld. And Victor was the director of the 1977 film, The Animals Film, which was a very, very popular film on the BBC. And recently he's revisited the subject of human-animal relationships in a BBC radio documentary called One Planet, Animals and Us. And this is an editorial that he wrote for the Guardian website. And I think he says some interesting things in it. And I'm going to ask Gary about these things because from my understanding from Twitter is that Gary quite liked this editorial and I'm curious to know why. The headline is, Five Fatal Flaws of Animal Activism. From tacky nude posters to dubious concepts such as happy meat, animal rights groups are losing the fight for real change. And remember, this is Victor Schoenfeld editorializing. Quote, there are a few things that have kept me going and kept me proud of how I've been living over the decades. Pretty near the top of that list is being a vegetarian for ethical reasons. That was deeply unfashionable back in 1977 when I abandoned meat eating and went on to make The Animals Film. I was over the moon when the film had a greater impact than I dreamed it would, and then I went back to human concerns in my creative work. It wasn't until some 30 years later, at the suggestion of the BBC World Service, that I returned to this terrain for the radio documentary series One Planet, Animals and Us. But I'd remained a vegetarian and so hoped to discover that the exploitation of animals for food and science had been reduced since the 1980s. What I found, however, was more than disappointing, a complete absence of decisive progress. Austria, with several new laws, has come closest to meaningful change, but even there the number of animals suffering for human needs and pleasures is undiminished, and the industrialized exploitation of animals for food is spreading across the globe. There has been one arguable advance, though, and that's been the progressive, quote-unquote, normalization of vegetarianism over the years. When I first settled in Britain, restaurants seldom offered vegetarian choices. Supermarkets barely catered to my needs at all. London's main vegetarian restaurant was named Crank's, and that said it all. Today, by contrast, families happily pop out to the corner shop to buy vegetarian foods to host my young daughter, and veggie options are steadily becoming staples in school lunch halls. In light of this, one New Zealand-based listener's criticism of my work for the BBC World Service stood out from the enthusiastic responses to the programs. Quote, so disappointing to hear Schoenfeld is still a vegetarian after so many years, she complained. What she was underlining is that I had not become vegan. Though I concluded the series with Professor Gary Francione calling for vegan education as the moral baseline for animal rights, that still left the question, what about me personally and the way I live now? I had stopped short of removing milk and eggs from my diet and all leather and wool from my clothing. I'd had my rationales for this, the main one being that I hadn't wanted to impose too zealously nonconformist a lifestyle on my family. Also in the 1980s, one of the traps of the animal rights movement was marginalization. So when I was interviewed about The Animals Film and journalists thought they'd caught me out in personal inconsistencies, I'd say I wore leather shoes or took milk in my coffee so that the implications of the film couldn't be dismissed by labeling the filmmaker as a fanatic. But now in the 21st century, supermarkets routinely cater to vegetarian food buyers, restaurant menus regularly display vegetarian symbols, and the harm to health and the global environment caused by factory farming has become established knowledge. It's time for vegans to become vocal. Even free-range eggs and organic milk production entail significant suffering, and the animals are killed when their productivity goes down. So on an individual level, I'm hopeful. But the Animals in Us series made vivid that organized group efforts on behalf of animals have been largely fruitless to date in terms of the end goals, and campaigns for small changes are quite possibly counterproductive. The organized activism is sorely in need of fresh perspectives. Thus, I submit here for scrutiny 5 fatal flaws of animal activism. 1. Instead of promoting animal rights goals as a major plank within broader social change movements, animal organizations insist on going it alone. Yet the Green Party's animal rights goals are as radical as any animal rights organizations. 2. One of the world's largest animal rights organizations routinely employs naked young women, including porn stars, to chase mass media attention. Would a human rights organization stoop so low? 3. Animal rights organizations have been handing out awards and lavishing praise on slaughterhouse designers and burger restaurant chains after quote-unquote negotiations for small changes that leave the system of exploitation intact. 4. Instead of animal rights organizations promoting a clear moral baseline that individuals should become vegan to curb their own demands for animal consumption, groups have given the stamp of approval to deeply compromised marketing concepts such as happy meat, freedom foods, sustainable meat, and conscientious omnivores. 5. Tactics of violence and personal intimidation have at long last fallen out of favor, but activists now pour energy and resources into organizations that lack any real strategy for bringing an end to animal exploitation, whether for food or science. Animal activists have not been asking themselves these difficult questions, and organizational self-promotion stunts substitute for the less glamorous work of figuring out how to help each of us change the way we live. Much noise, little change. Perhaps it's time to reverse that. And that, my friends, is the news for today. A lot to think about in that last piece, and I'm going to ask Gary Francione just what he thinks about that piece. Today we are going to be speaking with Gary Francione. He is a distinguished professor of law and Nicholas D. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law, Newark. He is author of numerous books and articles on animal rights theory and animals and the law, including Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, Animals, Property and the Law, and Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide to Conscientious Objection. He also has a forthcoming book, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation, which will be co-authored with Robert Garner and will be published by Columbia University Press in fall, winter 2009, now 2010. We're going to get a bit of a snapshot into the current state of the abolitionist animal rights movement, and we're going to be speaking specifically about Gary and many other people's campaign, internet campaign, The World is Vegan If You Want It. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm sorry. We have 5 dogs in the house, so you perhaps will hear a little bit of barking. But I assume that anyone who's listening to the program won't find that too terribly upsetting.
No, I think it's okay, and maybe you can introduce us to the dog that's barking now.
That's Robert, who's barking right now, and that's Maya that's barking right now. Okay. And at any moment, we could have a cacophony of all 5 of them barking.
Well, that's
but in any event, we'll try to keep it down.
That's okay with me. I wanted to ask you. I follow you on Twitter, and I was reading your Twitter feed yesterday, and you linked to an editorial by Victor Schoenfeld from The Guardian. And Victor Schoenfeld, as you know, and as you've been commenting on your blog, has recently done more work for the BBC in the form of the radio documentary One Planet, Animals and Us. And I wanted to get maybe if you could give us a bit of an expanded take on your Twitter feed. You had a short sort of post in praise of it and on your blog as well. It strikes me as a bit strange because on the one hand, he remarks and marks veganism as a somewhat extreme sort of thing in his editorial, and he talks about not wanting to marginalize himself or his family. And yet, at the same time, he seems to have a lot of opinions about how the animal rights movement should move forward in terms of vegan education. So I'm just wondering if maybe we could start off the interview by hearing what you think about that.
Well, first of all, I was very excited that BBC World Service did that. That is, BBC World Service is the most listened to radio And Victor Schoenfeld, you know, I'm old enough to remember seeing the animal film when it came out in 1982, and it had a profound impact on a lot of us because for many of us, it was the first time we had actually seen film footage of what went on in agriculture, what went on in vivisection. And I think that it was, you know, it was certainly a very, very influential film. Victor just returned to the issue. He's been doing other things in the meantime. He just returned to the issue and decided that he was going to do this two-segment program with BBC. And I spoke with him and the producer before the program was done. And I think in many ways our discussions helped to shape the program in certain ways because I think Victor, when he started off, perhaps had a more optimistic view of what was going on in the movement. Again, I don't want to speak for him, but this is my impression.
Sure.
And by the time we were done, I think he understood that there was a real need for crystal clarity in terms of principles, and that a big problem of the movement was that the movement wasn't going forward because it didn't have any principles. It didn't have any clear normative principles. It was just basically saying the same thing that was being said in the 1940s. Be nice to animals, be humane to animals, treat animals better. And the problem is treatment isn't the issue, use is the issue. And as we got further into it, we started talking about veganism and the importance of veganism and the importance of creative nonviolent vegan education. And by the time the program came out, the second segment ended with Victor recognizing the need for crystal clarity in principles and talking about and suggesting veganism as the moral baseline of the movement. He repeated that in the Guardian essay yesterday, and I know there were some people who said, well, wait a minute now, Victor hasn't been a vegan for much of his life, and that's true. Victor hasn't been a vegan for much of his life, but as he, I believe, himself posted on the Guardian yesterday in the comment section after the article, that he had recognized that veganism was now the moral imperative and that he was moving toward veganism. He was becoming a vegan. If he hasn't already, he was somewhat ambiguous in his response, but it's either the case that he is a vegan or he's becoming a vegan, and that he's recognizing that if we take animal interests seriously, veganism is a no-brainer. And rather than saying, as many animal advocates do, that veganism is the last step, you know, it's the last step we take. No, it's not. It's the first step we take. Once we recognize that they're morally significant, it's the first step that we take. And that the idea that vegetarianism is the gateway to veganism, or that vegetarianism is even a morally coherent position to take, is something we really need to sort of get beyond. If we take them seriously, the least we can do, the least, not the most, the least we can do is not wear them, eat them, or use them in any way.
In our pre-interview correspondence, you described the abolitionist animal rights movement as growing in leaps and bounds. I was wondering if you could briefly describe, I know we've done, this is one of many interviews that we've done with you on the program, and of course people can go to our website animalvoices.ca and listen back to all those programs to get probably a deeper overview of what abolitionism is, but I was wondering if you could just very, very briefly describe what abolitionism is and how, what are the leaps and bounds that you've noticed since the last time we spoke, which I believe was just about a year ago.
Okay. Well, abolition is basically the notion that we should seek to abolish animal exploitation and not regulate it. That the whole idea of animal welfare reform is morally problematic, that is, it fails as a moral theory, but as a practical matter, animal welfare reform doesn't and can't work because of the chattel status of animals. Animals are property, and because of certain things we call economic realities, animal welfare reform will always be limited, will always be at a very, very low level. Basically, we'll only protect animal interests to the extent that we get some sort of economic benefit from doing so. So the abolitionist position says we should abolish animal exploitation, not regulate it. But there are also other components, as I've developed the abolitionist theory over the past probably 20 years now, that is, it rejects racism, sexism, heterosexism. That is, it sees that there is a strong connection between the animal rights issue and other progressive social movements. I have been for 20 years now a virulent critic of the rampant sexism in the movement and the failure of the movement to generally recognize that the animal rights issue is connected with other progressive social movements and other progressive social ideas. And it's also connected with the idea of nonviolence. I am very, very disturbed at the number of people out there who believe that violence against humans, violence against property, whatever, other violence, that violence is a solution to the problem. The problem is violence. Violence isn't going to be a solution to the problem. And what I don't understand, I mean, putting aside the moral objections that one might have and that I do have to violence as a moral matter, I've never really understood the practical argument here. You can shut down 5 slaughterhouses. You can burn them down tomorrow. And you know what? If the demand is there, those 5 slaughterhouses are either going to be rebuilt, or 5 slaughterhouses that are currently in existence will expand, and the demand will be supplied. You can shut down Huntington Life Sciences. And you know what? If the demand for animals to be used in vivisection is still there, then some other supplier is going to meet that demand. So the idea that violence is ever going to be a solution is not only morally problematic, but it's practically silly. We've got to work on the demand. You know, the interesting thing is that the pro-violence movement and the animal welfare movement are very similar in that they both focus on institutional exploiters, and they make them the enemy. You know, the welfarists and the pro-violence people, they look at the institutional exploiters and they say, they're the enemy. Got news for you. We're the enemy. We, the people who demand animal products, we, the people who demand that vivisection still be done because we believe it's going to help our health, we, the people who demand the stuff, we're the exploiters. So the abolitionist position promotes the abolitionist opposed to the regulation of exploitation, connects the animal rights issue with other progressive social movements, identifies creative, nonviolent, vegan education as the primary activity for animal advocates, and absolutely rejects all forms of violence. Now, as far as what's been happening in the past year, I get about 300, and I mean 300 emails a day. I mean, I've been doing this work now for a long time. Mm-hmm. This is not something I've developed recently. I mean, I've been developing these theories since probably the late 1980s, and got into full speed in the 1990s. But remember something. At that time, the large animal groups controlled communication. So if they didn't like what you were saying, you didn't get invited to their conferences, they didn't promote your work, they didn't mention you, you didn't exist as far as new people coming into the movement were concerned. So during the 1990s, actually after I wrote Rain Without Thunder, in which I argued that the animal rights movement was collapsing, and I have news for you, it's collapsed. Mm-hmm. But it was in the process then of collapsing. I wrote that book in 1996, got an enormous amount of hate mail from all of these wonderful, peace-loving animal people, enormous amounts of hate mail, and basically I stopped being invited to all the conferences. None of the groups would sell any of my books or promote any of my work, and right. I basically dropped off the radar screen as far as the movement was concerned. I continued to lecture at universities and local groups.
The mainstream movement.
Oh, the mainstream movement, yeah. Right. But as much as I hate, you know, because I'm a Luddite, I don't really like these computers, but I have to say they have done, they did me good in the sense that what the Internet's done is it's eliminated the opportunity cost, or it's reduced the opportunity cost of communication. Mm-hmm. So that now we don't have to communicate through the large groups anymore, through the mainstream movement. So it doesn't really matter whether PETA doesn't like what I say, which they don't, or HSUS doesn't like what I say, which they don't, or any of the other large groups don't like what I say, which they don't. It doesn't matter. Because now I can communicate with people all over the world, and I do. And there is an abolitionist movement, and it's growing all over the world. I mean, we've got that abolitionist pamphlet, which Anna and I basically wrote in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. It's now in, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 languages. I don't even know how many we have it up there in now. Mm-hmm. A number of the videos that we have on the theory of animal rights versus welfare, animals as property, animal law, we have those in English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, German, and theory of animal rights was just put up in Japanese. We're getting more and more translations of the blog essays, of the abolitionist pamphlet, of the videos, of other materials on the site. I cannot keep up with the correspondence I'm getting. I certainly cannot go to all the places that people would like me to go to speak. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a lot of conferencing on Skype. I'm using Skype mm-hmm. to address groups. I recently did a lecture in Ireland while sitting in my office. I did a lecture in Ireland. I've done them in South America. I've done them in Western Europe. So I give lectures on Skype. You know, I do a fair amount of traveling and I'm going to continue to do that. But the abolitionist movement is growing. And what people understand is that they don't need leaders. They don't need large organizations. They don't need huge budgets. Creative, nonviolent vegan education is something any of us can do. Mm-hmm. We need to educate ourselves about the basics. And that's something that's very, very important. It's one of the reasons why I set that website up, was so that people could go to that website. It's not an entertainment website. It's an educational website. It's there to provide advocates with education, with the argument, with the basic principles of the abolitionist position, with the basic arguments about veganism, with the basic arguments about nonviolence. I mean, I think they should read the books as well, because in those books I develop those theories. But the website is intended to be an educational device in multiple languages for people. But education, not creative, nonviolent vegan education, is something that anyone can do. The mainstream movement has turned activism into sitting down, writing a check, send it to us, we'll make it all better. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that's nonsense. We don't need leaders. Everybody needs to become a leader. Everybody, if you care about this issue, you need to be a leader, you need to be a vegan, and you need to educate people in creative, nonviolent, non-aggressive ways about why they ought to be vegans. And you know what? It works. I cannot tell you the numbers of emails I get from people who were omnivores. We're not talking about people who were vegetarians. As a matter of fact, they're tougher. The people who are vegetarians are tougher. Tougher to get them to go vegan.
Right.
Because they give you 18 million arguments about, none of which make any sense, about why, well, you know, there's a real difference here because, you know, blah, 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 and they give you all sorts of nonsense. But I get all sorts of communication from omnivores all over the world who say, you know, I never thought about it this way before. I tell you, one of the most effective things I ever wrote was a few years ago when Mike Vick, the football player, mm-hmm. when he got busted for the dogfighting business.
Yeah, I remember your editorial about that.
Yeah, I was sick and tired of listening to, you know, Mike Vick, because it reminded me of O.J. Simpson. It reminded me of, you know, this is something white people do, and nobody even pays attention to it, but, you know, a rich black guy does, and we get all obsessed about it. And so I wrote this editorial, We're All Michael Vick, in which I said, hey, look, what's the difference between, you know, he likes sitting around a dogfighting pit watching dogs fight. The rest of us like to sit around our barbecue pits roasting animals who have been tortured every bit as much, if not worse, than Michael Vick's dogs. What's the point here, people? What's going on? I have to tell you something. The reaction I got to that was incredible. I'm not saying everybody liked it. A lot of people didn't like it.
Of course.
But a lot of people read that editorial, which was then reprinted this past summer after he got out of jail and he signed up with the Eagles. It was reprinted. And I cannot tell you the number of people who have written to me saying, you know what? I never thought about it that way. I never thought that while I'm sitting in the stands, being upset about Michael Vick playing for the Eagles while I'm eating my hot dog or hamburger, I'm not doing anything any differently from what he did with the fighting dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a question of snapping on the light, turning on the light, getting people to see we can do this.
I want to stop you really quickly and ask a quick sort
you
of devil's advocate.
Or I keep going. I'm like the the energized bunny.
I want to ask you a devil's advocate question, because at the top of the hour, I read mm-hmm. a story from the Associated Press about the U.S. livestock industry.
Mm-hmm.
And not sure if you're aware, but maybe you are. I'm guessing probably yes, but 2009 was quite possibly one of the worst years for mm-hmm. the U.S. livestock industry
mm-hmm.
in so many sectors, cattle, dairy,
right.
Pork, all those
mm-hmm.
words that cover up the thing that the thing actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the organizations, actually the only organization that they cite, and one of the groups that Bob Stallman, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, mm-hmm. says to his 5,000 members at a conference that they need to be worried about is a group like HSUS. And they're talking about this specifically because they see a group like HSUS as part of a sort of a set of groups that are intent on bringing in animal welfare mm-hmm. reforms, and thus, further damaging these industries economically. They don't seem to in any way be worried about what you or I would call nonviolent vegan education.